Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 153.
On today's show, we talk to Dr. Paul Zimmerman about the archaeological site Lagash in Iraq.
Let's dig a little deeper. All right, welcome to the show, everyone. Rachel, how's it going?
Pretty good, pretty good. Chilly, very cold here.
Yeah, so we left North Carolina, where we've been for the last 6 weeks, and this is our second day of travel. We're headed to a big event in Arizona, and for anybody that cares, and it's just been two long days of travel with 4.5 more long days of travel to go, and we're booking across the country, 2,200 miles, I think. Seeing a lot of the United States, we went through 5 states today, and not stopping a whole lot, but seeing a lot of it.
I mean, does it count as 5 states when you just cross through like a tiny corner of it?
Listen, Tennessee counts even if it was only for 20 minutes.
Oh, man.
All right. Well, today we've got somebody who is familiar to the Archaeology Podcast Network. He's my co-host on the Archaeotech Podcast, but he's also been on this show when he worked with us over the summer. I think we were on at least 2 or 3 shows we did with Paul. So welcome again to the podcast, Paul Zimmerman. How you doing, Paul?
Not pretty good. How are you guys?
Not too bad. Not
sounds like you're weathering, what, the storm in the south today and life in the RV and all that fun stuff.
Yeah, traveling across the country in the winter is not like the best plan anytime, like no matter what you're driving, but doing it in a 26,000-pound house towing your car is also hazardous. So we're trying to stay as far south as possible, but we still get hit by snow in Georgia last night. I didn't even know Georgia got snow. So, yeah.
Yeah, fun times. I'm envious. We haven't had much at all yet in New York. And I can't believe it's January already. And we don't have a blanket of snow. It's cold today, finally, for a change. But yeah, it just doesn't feel quite wintry to me.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you. Well, you know where else it doesn't feel wintry? Iraq. Because to me, it's the desert all the time. I don't know. We'll find out, though. We're going to talk about, and I don't even know if we mentioned it on this show. We may have mentioned having you on to talk about this, but on the Archaeotech podcast, if you guys are interested, go over to archpodnet.com/Archaeotech, and we'll probably include some links in the show notes. But we've mentioned a few times Paul's trip over to Iraq over the fall and the project that he was working on over there. Now, on those shows, we do get into a little bit about what he's doing, but we do, obviously, the thesis of the show is to discuss a little more about technology. So we do that on that show. So we talk about survey methods and, you know, this one of those episodes we recorded, we talked about GIS stuff. So, Paul, let's talk about Lagash, the site that you worked at in Iraq. Let's set the setting. Where in Iraq is this? And maybe for people who don't know, including myself sometimes until I look at a map, because I always forget, the whole area kind of just jumbles in my head. Like where's Iraq in relation to maybe some other countries around it? And then let's set the setting for Lagash.
Okay, great. No, so it's obviously it's in the Middle East. It's to the east of Saudi Arabia. It's to the west of Iran and south of Syria and Turkey, just at the headwaters of the Persian Gulf. So if you could bound it by all those different countries and by that body of water, you'd be right in the middle there. That's Iraq. The ancient Greek name for much of it is Mesopotamia, which I'm sure, as you remember from middle school, means the land between the rivers, the two rivers. And those rivers are the Euphrates, which runs more to the west, and the Tigris, which runs more to the east. And they both run basically long courses from north to south before they join up at a spot called the Shatt al-Arab. And that's where the two rivers can join and flow down into the Persian Gulf.
Okay.
So it's actually a fairly large country, but where we tend to focus on archaeologically, and this is definitely changing, but you know, anything that you would have remembered from your Mesopotamia study section in middle school would have been focused on what is now southern Iraq, mostly south of the capital of Baghdad. And that's kind of, if you can remember how those two rivers run, they kind of pinch together. They don't quite touch, but they pinch together kind of wasp waste at Baghdad, and then they spread out again a little farther east and west of each other through the south. And that area historically has been marshes and swamps and deserts and, you know, very rich and varied environment, but also very, very flat. It's basically all a floodplain.
Is that the area that's like known as the Fertile Crescent or whatever? I remember that from school.
Right. So the Fertile Crescent, you know, we always get taught that, and it kind of gets conflated with Mesopotamia. But as conceived, really, the Fertile Crescent is the foothills. So the Zagros Mountains and the Taurus Mountains, and then around through like the Anti-Lebanon Mountains and so on. So basically from the Levant, if you draw a big arc that goes up around through southern Turkey and through western Iran, that would be the Fertile Crescent. And that's area where there was a lot of, you know, firsts, a lot of first agriculture, a lot of first cities, such. And then it encroached inward meaning west and south into what's now Iraq.
Okay.
So yeah, depending how you remember it, how you were taught it, it could be considered the Fertile Crescent, but I like to think of the Fertile Crescent as farther uphill.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
But this whole, and the reason the Fertile Crescent got its name, right, is because that's where we've been taught that agriculture was first developed in the world, basically. I mean, it was independently developed in a number of areas, but first developed in that area, what, something like 10,000 years ago, give or take?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And the thing about it is, the reason why I like to push it up into the foothills is because that's the area where you can do dry farming, right? Where you can farm land based off of the available rainwater. To get down into the lowlands, and especially into the floodplain of southern Iraq, you really need to be able to manage the water. And the traditional way that's been done for millennia has been through canals. So canalizing the rivers, and also building canals that jut off of those rivers into agricultural fields, basically.
Okay. Sounds good.
Ooh, new favorite word, canalizing. I love it.
Oh, yeah. I may have just made it up. But.
I don't know. I don't think you did. I feel like I've seen it before, but like, yeah, that's definitely my favorite word of the day.
Channeling, nice. Maybe. Maybe that would have been a better word.
No, yeah. I like it.
It's like, I was going to say the canals on Mars.
right. Let's not go
which
there.
Is supposedly a mistranslation of the Italian canali, which meant channels, but
yeah.
Right.
That's a whole different thing.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. All right. So what? Now you got me thinking about Mars. That was Lowell, I think, that did that. Percival Lowell. Anyway, the Lagash. So where's Lagash in this whole crazy business?
Okay, so Lagash is fairly far south. It's in a large governorate, a large province in the south of Iraq called Dhigar, and it's closer to the Euphrates. In antiquity, it was probably pretty close to at least one of the channels. And there's canals that run all through the areas, including possibly one that runs right through the middle of the site. And you're going to have to break out a map, but if you look at Nasiriyah and you go pretty much 25 miles straight north of Nasiriyah, you'll find Lagash.
Okay. All right. Now, what is... Now, we're going to talk about the site, of course, but just kind of setting up here in segment one. Is Lagash an existing city now these days, or is it just the archaeological site and historic place that you guys are looking for? Or, yeah, is there something existing today of Lagash?
Yeah, so that's actually a really interesting question, because some places you do have existing cities on top of the ancient tells. This is one that was abandoned in antiquity. And, there may have been a small Islamic, I don't know what time period, presence on it, but for the most part, it's just an empty site.
Okay.
It's a tell site, and its modern name is Tell al-Hibba, but Lagash is the ancient Sumerian name for it.
Gotcha.
And we'll use the names interchangeably, or sometimes call it al-Hibba / Lagash, depending on who's writing and who's talking. I tend to just call it Lagash. because Lagash is a name that you may also have heard, you know, maybe again back in that middle school intro to Mesopotamia class.
Nice.
So because this word is not super familiar to me, I'm sure it's not to people who are listening, but what is a tell?
Oh, great. So a tell is the typical type of site that you get in Mesopotamia. And basically what it is an accumulation of building debris and other debris in one spot over the centuries. And so the main building material in Mesopotamia is mud brick. Right. So that's like adobe. You take mud, you take clay, you take straw, maybe dung, depending on who's building, what time period, whatnot. You make bricks out of them. But then instead of firing the bricks, you let them sun dry and then you stack them and you use more mud as mortar to build up the buildings. And what happens is over the centuries, the buildings deteriorate with the sun and the wind and the rain, and the buildings get knocked down and people keep on rebuilding in the same spot over and over. And that accumulation then of building level upon building level builds these massive man-made, human-made sites that are mounds that are visible above the plain, but they're not intentionally built as such. I mean, there may be advantages that we can get into as to why people would want to live in one spot and have it slowly over the centuries rise. But that accumulation in one place where people lived is the like typical site for ancient Mesopotamia. And that's called a tell.
Cool. Right.
I think for some reason, I always thought tell meant hill in that language.
It does. But there are other words for hill that would be used for a natural hill. So depending on where I've been in Yemen, I think I usually use the word Salm. And in Iraq, I learned, at least in this area, they call it Ishan, is for just a hill as a general word. But a tell is something very specific. It's human made.
That's really cool. And it makes sense because like people always want to keep living in the same places. I don't know if it's because it's familiar or it's resources or what, but like even when Chris and I were in Philadelphia, like we're standing at ground level and they're showing the first president's house below the surface of the ground because the city has just raised that much since it was built 300 years ago. It's just that much higher now. So people do that.
And that's something that you'll see, especially if you travel in Europe. You'll see, if you go into the old city center or any place, you'll often see doorways. You know, the front door to the house is actually below ground level. So there'll be a few steps down from the street into the front door. And that is, like you're saying, because things accumulate. Now, that might be more trash accumulation, repavings, and so on. So it's a different process than a tell. But yeah, people do tend to live in the same place. And if people live in the same place, they accumulate garbage around themselves. You know, whether that's garbage or whether that's building debris, depends where and how and, you know, a lot of different things. But
interesting.
But yeah, so people tend to live in the same place.
Okay. Well, I think on that note, let's take a break and then we'll come back and talk a little bit more about what Lagash is and where it sits in history. So we'll do that on the other side of the break. Back in a minute. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 153. And we are talking to, I forgot to mention, Dr. Paul Zimmerman of the Archaeotech podcast. And I got to bring that out. You're the guest this time. So anyway,
if you work with us again next summer, I'm just going to call you doctor.
Yep, that's right. Doctor.
Dr. Zimmerman was my dad.
Nice. Oh, man. Did you just go home? Doctor. Okay.
Doctor.
So doctor.
Oh, nerd.
So let's talk more about Lagash. So what time period are we talking about with Lagash? When was this not buried in dirt and sand and other mud bricks?
Right. So it's an interesting site because it's really large. It's about 450 hectares, depending where you want to draw the boundary of it, because it's a low site. It's not a big mound like a lot of tell sites are, but it's very broad. If you want to draw the boundaries a little farther out because of buffer zones or changes through time, whatever, probably bump it up to as much as, you know, even 600 hectares in size. The main occupation of the site is from the middle of the third millennium BCE, from a time period called the early dynastic period. And this is the time period that you think about when you think about Sumerians, right? So Sumerians are the people that first built buildings, cities, the first writing, all this stuff happening in this part of the world. This is a little bit later. By the early dynastic, there's, you know, a fully developed suite of different cultural traits that we can identify as Sumerian, from their art, from their language, their writing, you know, how they live and so on. And we're trying to definitely flesh that out and have been for well over 100 years now. Mm-hmm. But in the middle of the time period is that early dynastic Sumerian culture. And that's when the site of Lagash is at its fluorescence. That's when it's the biggest thing. In the late early dynastic period, it was probably the most powerful city in that area. And so where I said you may know something about it, though you may have forgotten from your middle school class, is that one of the more famous monuments of Mesopotamian art is something called the Stele of the Vultures. Mm. And a stele is a big flat rock usually that's carved and often inscribed, and it's set up to commemorate some event, to mark territory, to do different kinds of things like that. It's basically a billboard. The Stele of the Vultures is a rock that was commissioned by one of the kings of Lagash to commemorate his victory over the king of a neighboring city a little farther to the north called Umma. And in that, they were both fighting over some fertile plains that were between the two cities, watered by canals. You know, if you're in that part of the world back then, and so much land is swampland, and you have to drain some of it in order to make fields, and you have to bring the water into some of the fields with canals in order to water them so you can grow things. And you live in cities, and these are big urban centers, and people are concentrated in those urban centers, and they need all that land in order to grow the food so that the people can live in the cities. It becomes a very complex system, and it's often ruled by very strong priests and or kind of priest king sort of figures. And the king of Lagash then commemorates with the Stele of the Vultures this victory and against Umma and winning over the plains that are between them. And it's called the Stele of the Vultures because it's in fragments, but one of the fragments shows the decapitated heads and body parts of the Umma soldiers being carried off by vultures.
Nice. There you go.
Yeah, that's pleasant. Looking at pictures of it now, obviously, because, you know, that's what you do when you have the internet in front of you. And it's really cool. It's definitely nice. Something to check out for sure. It's really neat. Those pictures are crazy.
Before we go too much further, Paul, you mentioned, and I may have missed this because I was also looking them up, you mentioned the dynastic period and the early, middle. What time frame is that? You know, how many hundreds, thousands of years ago are we talking here?
Right. So basically, we're talking about the middle of the third millennium BCE. So from 2700-2800 BCE until around 2300-2200 BCE, depending on the chronology that you're using and so on. But that's a good rough range. And so what we're talking about is around 2300-2200 BCE with this late early dynastic period when Lagash is the big thing. That's when it's best known for, but actually the name carries on. And that's when it gets a little complicated, is that after the early dynastic period, which is the fluorescence of the Sumerian civilization, what we have is the Akkadian period. And the Akkadians are Semitic speakers. So they speak a language. Sumerian is not related to any other language, known language. It's an isolate. And Akkadian, however, is a Semitic language. So it's related to Aramaic, it's related to Arabic, it's related to Hebrew, it's related to a number of other languages. And that was our in to finding out about Sumerian languages, that people figured out it was Akkadian was a Semitic language. They started to translate it, and then they started to see that there were these words that would creep in that had obviously not Semitic roots. And that's where they started to flesh out Sumerian. And this is where it really starts to get complicated, is that Mesopotamia is this weird kind of melting pot that over the millennia, you have people coming in from other areas, settling there and adopting a lot of the same sort of practices, adopting a lot of the administrative practices, adopting the writing, the languages mix a little bit. You know, definitely, I'm sure there must be a lot of gene mixing amongst people because people boink. That's a technical
term.
The anthropological term.
For sure.
And so the Akkadians, even though they're in some respects, a different culture, also assimilate to a lot of the Mesopotamian culture in a grander sense, which is originally, I guess, Sumerian. Anyhow, after this, the Akkadian period, there's a period at the very tail end of the second millennium called, of the third millennium called the Neo-Sumerian period. And that's a bit of a cultural revival. So if you think like a classical revival architecture, what you get is a Neo-Sumerian revival. And one of the bigger states in this area is called the state of Lagash. And so you would naturally think that the state of Lagash would be centered still on the site of Lagash. But what happens at that point is that the center of the state of Lagash has moved to that site, Umma, that we were talking about earlier, that was their former foe. And that's where the kings of Lagash rule from. So it does get a little confusing. You may also, the other reason why you may possibly have heard of Lagash, and if you haven't heard of this name, you definitely will have seen statuary of this guy, is that one of the most prolific builders and commemorators of himself in statuary of that Neo-Sumerian period is a guy called Gudea of Lagash. And and so you'll see diorite statues of him. They're very stylized, very, very repetitive in the way that they're done, though there's a lot of variability within them. But, you know, he's always got this big head. He's got, he wears the same kind of, it looks kind of like a wool cap if you were to roll up the brim. And he's always commemorating how pious he is, building building temples for the various gods. And he's always shown with like very muscular arms, oversized eyes.
I was just looking at a picture of him and I'm like, wow, those are some biceps.
Yeah, right. So that's all taken to be, you know, symbolic of how strong of a leader is. He's got this big head and these big eyes because he's very wise and intelligent. He's got these strong arms because he is the embodiment of strength of the state. It's done in diorite, which isn't a natural stone there, or a native stone there. It's imported probably from like Oman. So all these things are just are consolidating this sense of power and piety in this statuary of this one guy. But the confusion is that it comes from the site of Umma. And in the early part of the 20th century, that was excavated very heavily by a French project. And they thought that that was the site of Lagash. And it wasn't until the excavations at Al-Hibba that proved that Al-Hibba was the actual city of Lagash.
Okay.
Oh my gosh, it does get really confusing, doesn't it?
No, it's really simple.
It's like a big melting pot of people just kind of like swirling around this area at different times.
Yeah, and I'm sure I'm not doing a very good job of explaining it because there are plenty of other people who can do a much better job than I can, but that's my understanding and that's and I'm sticking with it.
Sounds
nice.
Good.
Nice. Yeah. So it sounds like we actually know quite a bit about Lagash. What are the sources of information right now that you're pulling from for this, with the fact that, you know, you're doing surveys and doing excavations or getting ready to do excavations anyway at Lagash? What's the source of the information we have now? Is this historical records from other excavations and areas or just like ethnographic accounts? Not ethnographic, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, certainly there's a lot of inscriptions, and that's one of the benefits of working in a place like Mesopotamia where there is written language for so long and that they wrote on a material that's fairly durable. They wrote on clay tablets. The clay can deteriorate, but thousands, tens of thousands of clay tablets have been found, probably hundreds of thousands, and they can be read, right? Despite being different languages, right? Between Akkadian and Sumerian, they can be read by modern scholars. So some of the information that we know about comes from these various different inscriptions. Some of it comes from excavations from other sites. Some of it comes from excavations at Lagash. Lagash, there were a couple minor excavations in the early 20th century. And then there was a fairly major excavation that was started in 1968. I don't know what year it got stopped for a bit, but got stopped for a bit by the Iran-Iraq War and then resumed in 1990. And that was a project that was done. It was a joint project between the Metropolitan Museum of Art and the Institute of Fine Arts at NYU. And that's one of the hooks that I have to this site, is that the principals on that project were the same people, Donald Hansen and Edward Oxenschlager, who brought me to Yemen initially to work on their project there. So these are very accomplished scholars. They'd been excavating all over, but Hansen in particular really made his name in Mesopotamia as one of the premier Mesopotamian art historians and archaeologists. And so that project, 68 to 90, was run by those two. The current director of the project is Dr. Holly Pittman at University of Pennsylvania. She was my wife's advisor. So she was also on the 1990 project, the 1990 season of that project, as was one of my best friends. So I have a lot of connections to the site, even though I'd never been there.
And, you know, if I hadn't already talked to you about the people and the early excavations and the 1990 ones, you know, on the other podcasts and just personally, I would be a little suspect if you were to tell me an excavation from the 60s was orchestrated by the Metropolitan Museum of Art and the Institute of Fine Arts. Mm-hmm. I would be like, is this a pot-henning exhibition? Are they trying to fill the museums? Like, what is going on here? But maybe for people also possibly thinking that, what was the impetus between those two institutions, if you even know this answer, to start digging there? Why did they do it?
Yeah, you know, I really should know the answer to that, and I don't off the top of my head. Hansen had been working all over Mesopotamia. He made his name as a grad student working at the site of Nippur. Mm-hmm. And I think it was because it was a very large, very historically important site that had not really been properly excavated. And Hansen was a big proponent of careful scientific excavations.
Sure.
You know, maybe the standards have changed between 1968 and now, but for the time, he was one of the premier excavators. His focus, even as an art historian, he was a very good archaeologist, and his focus was always architecture. So that looking for ancient architecture is something that he instilled in me and taught me some techniques of, and it's always been my kind of go-to interest in archaeology is ancient architecture.
Okay, cool. Well, I want to talk about what you guys are finding now, but we'll probably save that for segment three, or what your research questions are, what you're trying to look for, you know, what the whole point of the current effort is in segment three. But is there anything you can tell us about the history of excavations that we haven't already talked about? I'm trying to think, was there anything that happened prior to the 60s, or was it just basically, that's a good place to go? Why did it take up until the 60s, do you think? Do you have a personal opinion on that? Like, it sounds like if it's a really important site, and I know there's been focus in a lot of areas in Mesopotamia, you know, the Middle East in the past, just because of its important historical significance. But why do you think it took till the 60s to get to Lagash?
Yeah, I'm not certain. It was, like I said, there was some minor work that was done beforehand. And we should provide in the show notes a link to the Lagash Archaeological Project's website, where they have a bit of the history of the excavations there. And I don't know what finally pushed it over the edge. I'm guessing it probably was there's so many sites in Iraq, and there's so many people that wanted to work there, that it had to be a scholar with significant gravitas recognition in the field to be able to get the right permission to work on a site of this scale and this potential importance. So I think it was just a confluence of, you know, money, personnel, timing, and so on that all kind of came together with that 68 project.
Okay. Well, sounds good. At least I got to it, right? Yep. There you go. All right. Well, let's take a break then. And on the other side, we'll talk about what they're doing out there now in 2021, 22, what the research questions are, and what we still have to learn from Lagash. Back in a minute. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 153. And we've talked about where Lagash sits in the Middle East, formerly Mesopotamia. We've talked a little bit about where Lagash sits chronologically and historically in significance. And now I want to talk about the current efforts at Lagash. What prompted this return to Lagash, aside from some lessening of COVID restrictions?
Well, actually, the project started, the first season of it was in 2019. COVID restrictions is what scuttled 2020. And 2021 was just a little runt project, just four of us, in order to get some data. The primary mission was to get some data for Dr. Pittman's grad student, who's doing soil cores. Mm-hmm. he's looking at the environment, the ancient environment in southern Mesopotamia, trying to answer some questions about what was marsh and what was swamp, where was the actual coastline of the Persian Gulf in antiquity. A lot of questions we have about where the water was and what kind of water it was, because that helps inform how the people lived in these cities. And so there's, you know, if you go to a lot of Mesopotamia now, especially after Saddam drained the swamps, you see lots of dry, parched earth, and they're going through a very bad drought at the moment. So it's even exacerbated. And so the impression you can get is that, well, they had to get the water from these rivers and bring them in canals in order to feed the fields. And then people lived next to where those fields were, and that's how these tells formed. But there's also plenty good reason to believe that it might be something different. It might be that there were some natural high spots, and that's where people tended to live to build more permanent structures. And that over time built up the tells, but that a lot more of the water area around was swampier, which implies a lot of very interesting dynamics between people who lived primarily in the swamps, between the nomads who undoubtedly were there, and the urban dwellers. So the project right now is to really get a handle on how Lagash looked and worked as an urban center. Hmm. You know, it wasn't abandoned, even though the power moves up north. It's handy for us to ask questions about it, because a lot of what we can see in terms of the pottery that's on the surface and in terms of the architecture that we can see from the sky is that it fits into that early dynastic period. But there are other time periods that are represented there. So those early excavations, they're mostly focused on early dynastic. They found some major temples. And those temples are in the highest part of the site. It's possible that this site became, after it stopped being the most important urban center, might have still been an important ceremonial center. We don't know the answer to that. The questions that we're going forward to on the next season, and right now the principals on the project are actively working on writing an NSF application, an NSF grant application. And it's going to look heavily at patterns of craft production and industry across the site.
Okay.
One of the things I didn't mention is there was a surface survey done in 1984 by Elizabeth Carter, and she found areas of a lot of shell, areas of a lot of slag, and those are probably correlated with different parts of the site that were devoted to workshops and kilns and so on. And so we want to re-examine that to get a sense of how, the parts of the city where people lived and the parts of the city where people worked, how those work together. And that's always a common question with Mesopotamian sites, probably sites anywhere in the world, but it's a recurrent question with Mesopotamian studies.
That's really cool. Do you think that, what kind of preservation does the site itself have? Like, will you guys be able to find like potentially preserved organic materials to get an idea of the type of stuff that you don't normally find in the archaeological record, basically?
Yeah, so that's one of the things that they want to do. They definitely want to do some more soil coring. But on tell sites, you can often find drains, right? And so they'll often have these drains, big, like half meter or meter across rings, stacked vertically. And so they're like, probably taking sewage straight down and trying to dump them down into the water, into the water table down below. That should be packed with organic remains. And so I think that part of the grant that they're writing will be to look at that, if not for this upcoming season, definitely in the near future, is to take samples out of as many of these drains as feasible. And this is a multi-pronged project going forward here. So, I'm still hopefully going to be part of it. I'm still going to be doing surveys. We were talking on the last Archaeotech podcast about the survey plan, the methodology I was doing for surface collections. But we're going to continue with our aerial survey, because you can see a lot of in parts of the sites, especially after the spring rains, you can see the footprints of the buildings, the soil stains of the walls. And so we can get a lot about the urban layout just from, without even excavating, just from looking at it from the sky. But we also want to add in things like magnetic radiometry and thermal imaging and, all sorts of other non-invasive techniques in order to try to build up a fuller picture of how the city worked as a city in antiquity.
That's super cool. And I know you guys talked about this on Archaeotech already, but since you're talking about the work that you're doing specifically, maybe give us a little like overview of how you're doing the work, how you're getting the aerials.
Yeah. Okay. So the cliff note of it is that we have a drone. It's a DJI Phantom 4 RTK and a base station. So basically that uses four different GPS systems, GPS, GLONASS, forgetting the name of the Russian one at the moment, and the or is GLONASS Russian? Well,
I'm trying to think. GLONASS is Russian, isn't it?
Yeah, I think GLONASS is. So what's the European one called?
Doesn't matter.
Yeah, yeah. So anyhow, and the European one and the Chinese one, Beidou. And the drone has antennas for all four systems, and there's also a base station that has antennas for all four systems. And so the drone flies like any other drone. We program in a flight path, take a lot of photographs over the site, and stitch them together with photogrammetry. And because cool. It's that system, it can know its position really accurately, like within a couple centimeters.
Nice.
And then on top of that, we're going to be flying. I was just in touch with some people about getting a thermal camera, and we want to do some thermal imaging, because if we go back in the spring, those soil stains that I was talking about should show up much more visibly. Mm-hmm. And it'd be great to compare then, you know, what we can see in regular photography, aerial photography, that is, versus what we can pick up with the thermal imaging versus what we can do with other kinds of non-invasive techniques. And the idea is that hopefully we can layer all these different things together, these different kinds of techniques, and get a really sharp, clear picture of how the city was put together.
Nice. Now that leads me to a question going back a few minutes ago to where you were talking about discovering more about, you know, what the urban center looked like at Lagash, right? And my question is, do we have reason to believe that it's different from any other contemporaneous urban center in the area, or we just don't really know a whole lot about it, so we need to excavate to find out?
It's questionable how much we'll need to excavate. I mean, certainly there will be some excavations going forward, but right now the focus has been on non-invasive techniques.
Okay.
And unfortunately, I've been out of the field long enough that I don't know the proper answer to that. I know that everybody is focused on urbanism and the mm-hmm. city layouts, you know, and when I say everybody, I mean teams from various different countries working on all sorts of different sites, not just in Mesopotamia, but or not just in southern Iraq, but all over Iraq and Kurdistan, nobody's working in Syria right now, to the best of my knowledge. But that was a question that was going on with a lot of Syrian sites. So it's a regular question, and I can't answer for you other than in the very broadest term that's what a lot of people are looking at. I can't tell you how distinct we expect this to be, but even if it's very similar to what other people have found elsewhere, that's still extremely significant and interesting.
Yeah, that is. I mean, obviously, even if we know everything about, you know, the same type of city and the same type of area, there's always a little something, right, that comes up. And we just, you know, as archaeologists, it helps to just get out there, do a survey, do whatever you can do, you know, to find out more information. It just helps put that one more puzzle piece in that area for that time frame, you know, into the big picture. So that's super cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I was wondering, too, because we were talking about on the Archaeotech podcast, which if you're listening to this in real time, came out yesterday. And or not yesterday, a couple days ago. And we're talking about the fact that you guys are getting ready to one of the things you want to do is a big surface survey. And I didn't think about this in the Archaeotech podcast, but you just mentioned, you know, previous excavations, the big surface survey that was done in, I think you said 1984, 86. And it made me think, I mean, this is a, you know, 4,000-year-old site. And it's been, I'm sure that soil accumulation has happened in that time, but now over the last couple hundred years, more than likely, there's been more soil deterioration with climate change and things like that. So, man, what could possibly be left on the surface, or are things constantly eroding out in this day and age of climate change and things are being revealed? I'm curious as to what the surface would even look like of a site that, you know, people have been living near and possibly walking over and just picking things up on for the last several thousand years.
Yeah. So if you go to pretty much any tell site and you walk across it, you will be walking across potsherds. They just come up to the surface. it's very different than you know, surface survey that you might do other places, because the density of potsherds is incredible. And yeah, certainly you get places where you have accumulation, wash, or, you know, alluvial accumulation. Alluvial, that definitely is possible. But I was also thinking aeolian accumulation. You get a sand dune, for example. So you can get things obscured like that. The quantity is such that even across 4,000 years, I don't think that you have a meaningful depletion of the stuff that's seen on the surface. I don't think that people are picking up broken bits of pottery in quantities to really deeply change what you will see on the surface now. I mean, that said, though, looting has been a problem, especially in the chaos after the last couple of wars in Iraq. And so if you're on a site that's been heavily looted, that pockmarks them in a bad way, which will definitely mix contexts. You're going to be seeing a lot of things that are from earlier in the site tossed up to the surface. It's going to be harder to map. Yeah, there are a lot of reasons, just practical reasons why that's going to make it more difficult. Fortunately, Lagash was not looted, and I'm going to have to figure out what I do about the places where those early excavations were digging. You know, if I have a test that happens to land in one of their old trenches, that's probably not the most useful for me. Or if I have a test that lands on one of their old spoil heaps, that's also probably not the most useful for me. But again, it's a huge site, and so those only form a small percentage of the entire site area. So, you know, I'll figure that bit out when we actually start working. But yeah, pottery everywhere. My biggest fear is that I've designed a system that's actually going to collect too much stuff.
That reminds me when I worked in Peru, it was kind of the same situation, and we had a rule that you didn't keep any piece of pottery that was smaller than your thumbnail. Like, you just didn't keep it. It wasn't worth it. Right. We tossed it.
And again, we talked about this on Architect. Part of what I'm putting together is a system that we can do with a minimal amount of training and with a minimal amount of archaeological knowledge, actually. So a lot of projects would go and they would collect, for example, diagnostic potsherds. You get something that's got distinctive decoration on it. You get something that's a rim shirt or a base shirt that can let you readily identify the vessel type. Those would be picked up. But that takes a certain amount of know-how on the part of the surveyor. What I want to do is just a full coverage, you know, in small samples where you pick up everything, including those tiny little broken bits of pottery. And then we can count them and weigh them and do heat maps in our GIS afterwards based off of that.
Oh, that's interesting.
We'll see how that actually works.
Yeah, you could get some really cool data about like the spread of vessel types potentially and decoration and that kind of thing, maybe.
Yeah. And if there's chronological differences, if we see like certain parts of the site belong to one time period and not to another, that's interesting. You know, again, it's a huge site, but was it always basically in the configuration that we see, or did, you know, the densest parts of the site migrate? Did those industrial areas migrate over time? You know, we don't know yet, and we're going to be hopefully answering some of those questions.
You know, that's super cool. One thing that I'm always curious about is beginnings and endings, and I'm curious, especially endings with cities like this. Right? Is there anything in the inscriptions or historical record from other places on why Lagash was ultimately abandoned? Do we know that yet? Or is that maybe something we could hope to find out during, you know, future work?
Yeah, actually, I don't know. I think my colleagues have ideas as to why it was abandoned, but I myself don't know. And, you know, it's kind of funny that you're interviewing me about this, because having been out of the field for so long, there's so much that I've forgotten. And it's kind of embarrassing, but well, you know, we're always learning things, you know. And that's a good thing, right?
Yeah.
That's cool. I mean, you've told us so many cool things about the site. And I wanted to ask one more question more about like the actual like doing of the work itself, because this is in Iraq, which is a place that isn't or hasn't historically been a super safe place to go. So I'm just wondering how it is like from a safety perspective, traveling there, being there, living there and interacting with the local people, if you even do interact with them very much. And what's that like?
Yeah, so it was a little odd when we were there. I didn't feel unsafe at any point. Let me just lay that out there.
That's good.
Yeah, I found everybody to be very friendly and inviting. I didn't have any kind of belligerence directed at me, or I didn't even see any belligerence directed at Americans in general, though I do know that exists. Safety is a big concern of the project. It's a big concern of the Antiquities Department. And Americans are problematic safety-wise. You know, people mm-hmm. are much less upset by Italians than they are by Americans there. Mm-hmm. For example, that said, again, I didn't feel anything unsafe, but because of those concerns when we were there, even though it was just four of us and one of the four is Iraqi, though it was just the four of us, we had two different dispatches of police, one from the Antiquities and one from the Digar province that were living in large tents right next to our house. Mm. I could not go onto the site, even though it was 100 feet, maybe. From the site, I could not go out onto the site by myself without an escort.
Wow.
So we'll see if that continues next time. I'm hoping that it doesn't, because it slows things down, you know, and it means that it makes it harder when, you know, when you're working in the field, one of the great things is to be able to make friends with the people that you're working with and mm-hmm. visit them, you know, drop by their house, they drop by your house. We certainly had a lot of visitors drop by our house, but it wasn't the kind of thing that I could just casually go visit one of our Department of Antiquities representatives, even though, you know, at his house, even though his house wasn't very far away. It just wasn't going to be in the cards. And so I'm hoping that that eases up a bit, but I'm not really holding my breath for it.
Okay. Well, I really look forward to having you on both the Archaeotech podcast and this podcast with further updates. I hope you guys get the funding and get to go out there. You mentioned making it easy for, you know, untrained and unskilled people, which I hope means Rachel and I can come out there.
Neither
of us know anything about the Middle East.
Turn around is fair play, right? After you guys did that with me in Nevada.
Exactly. We won't even ask you to pay us.
Right? Hey, Rachel, be quiet. Anyway,
cat's out of the bag. It's been real, right? You can't edit that out. It's the law.
Anyway, really looking forward to hearing more about this. Check it out. We'll have some links in the show notes. I've got the Lagash Archaeological Project that Paul mentioned earlier, and then the episode that we did on Archaeotech. And I'll probably include the link to the episode that's actually coming out post this recording, but pre you listening to this. And because we talked about some of the methods that they would be using on future survey projects. So, wow. Thanks again, Paul, for coming on. This has been really fantastic.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks
it's
for
so
having
interesting.
Me. I'm glad you liked it. I did too.
All right. Thanks, everybody, and we'll see you next week.
Bye. Take care.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at arcpodnet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster and Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.